You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hello, welcome back to episode 31 of the Untaming podcast. I hope you found last week's episode with Amy Haas on the Brewer eating plan valuable as a resource for pregnancy to prevent a lot of avoidable complications. That, along with my interview with Gail Tully from Spitting Babies in episode 21, are by far my two most simplest recommendations for pregnancy. I realised I haven't read out some reviews for a few weeks. Here's one from Alicia2792 in the United States. This podcast is wonderful for parents that want to raise children in a way that fits with our biological norm. The expectations we have for mums and babies in our culture is so far off from what nature intended. I have a 14-month-old son and started off my mothering journey stressed and worried that I was doing things wrong by breastfeeding on demand and to sleep and co-sleeping. I slowly started to learn over the first year of his life that all of this was normal and I was doing myself and my son justice by parenting this way. I wish I could have listened to these podcast interviews before having my son. Such a great resource. Well, thanks, Alicia. Your son must be thriving with all the wonderful loving you're lavishing on him and how thoroughly you're meeting his needs. And this one from Jill with a lot of numbers after. She titled her review, "This Podcast Saves Lives." Wow. A group of passionate, independent-thinking guests interviewed by a genuine host. This podcast lifts the curtain and lets us peer into the absurd aspects of our society, social norms, and the history of how these wacky ways became normal, and how we can get back on track to a more natural and in-tune lifestyle with our little ones. Listening to this podcast gives me the courage to follow my instincts as a parent in the midst of judgment and adversity. Thank you, Emily, for dedicating your time to find these insightful guests and making this wonderful podcast. It is truly a beacon of light in these strange times. The vast majority of the time I devote to this podcast is in that short period of time at night between my kids falling asleep and then me falling asleep. And it's reading reviews like these that really validates that sacrificing that me time is all worth it. Thank you so much, Jill. Your feedback is precisely what I strive for. The next episode to come out in 2 weeks is with husband and wife duo Anita and Nathan of the Homeschool Project podcast. They'll be giving us some insight into homeschooling, giving us a glimpse into their own lives, and sharing some of what they have learned. But today we have Ash Perrin, also known as Bash the Clown, and he has a lot to say with regards to play and his work in refugee camps, orphanages, as well as the polar opposite of performing for children of the wealthy elite. So here is Ash. Ash Perrin is 38 and three quarters. He was born in Kent, grew up in Bedfordshire, and currently lives in his show truck, basically on the road. 12 years ago, Ash set up the Flying Seagull Project, a troupe of entertainers engaging children and adults in art, music, craft, circus skills, games, and performances. They have since worked in a wide range of settings in the UK and around the world, ranging from children's hospitals, orphanages, and refugee camps to festivals and parties. The underlying philosophy of the Flying Seagull Project is that everyone, adults and children, have the right to put aside the cares of life and smile for a while. Last year, he published a book, The Real Play Revolution, Why We Need to Be Silly with Our Kids and How to Do It. Not only does it make a passionate case for the importance of play in children's lives, it is also a treasure trove of play ideas, activities, games, and jokes for everyone. Last night he had 6 hours of sleep, and for dinner tonight he had Greek potatoes with Thai vegetable curry. Ash, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
So a good friend of mine sent me through a link to an interview you did a little while ago, And I was so intrigued with what you had to say that I tracked down your book, Real Play Revolution, and read it. It was a very easy read, and there are so many things I would like to chat with you about. But to start, could you tell us how you started the Flying Seagull Project? I understand you were in an orphanage in Cambodia?
Yeah, so I worked as a performer, and through drama school, I went to acting school, and we weren't kind of very well off. So I had the course was paid for by a scholarship, but I had to work throughout. So I got a job doing kids parties at the weekends, which is, you know, fairly well paid. And then I left drama school, and believe it or not, I didn't go straight to Hollywood. No one called. My big break didn't arrive. So I just kept doing these kids parties, and it was it's quite an easy life. You know, you can earn a fair bit of money in a short time, and then there's massive dry periods. So in the summer, you don't have any work, and so I kind of travelled and worked and worked and travelled. And then, yeah, I was in an orphanage in Cambodia, and as much as that may sound like a noble thing, it was, if I'm totally candid, it was just a thing you do when you're in your early 20s in Cambodia. You go into these horrific genocide museums, you go to an orphanage, and it's a very irresponsible type of tourism, if I'm honest. But anyway, I was there.
Just to get like a cultural sort of experience, is that right?
Yeah, kind of. There are some good examples of it. And actually, the orphanage I was in that day, I've been back to with the project since. And it is very well run, and it is more responsible. But it's a way they raise money, and it's a way that, you know, basically voluntourism is what it's called. So you pay and you go and you feel good about yourself, and then you leave and the orphanage makes some cash. But I was there and I had a really cheap guitar. I was playing some songs and the kids were just like glued, you know. It's like they'd never, and I'm not very good on the guitar, so if Hendrix was playing, sure, but you know, I'm a bit more like the Oasis or something, you know. I've got four chords in my repertoire, and they were glued. And when I left the next day, I think I was there 2 days, I'd done a little bit of magic, I took a kit with me. And I was just thinking about these kids, and I was just thinking, you know, that it's no one's job to kind of invest in their personalities or care if they feel okay or comfort them if they're worried, you know, or have a nightmare and all those little things. And I thought, the phrase it was like, there's no one to hug them if they cry. And I just thought that was so, you know, we weren't wealthy growing up, but we had a very tight family and very loving parents and a, you know, very loving home, with lots of hugs and lots of comfort, like emotional comfort, I should say. So, yeah, that thought that these kids grew up without that was just, it just shook me to tears. And I sobbed for a good while. And then when we got out the other end of the taxi ride, me and my sister, I just wrote the whole project out. Like, this is what's going to happen. This is what I'm going to do. You know, I, the very least, I can make them laugh. I can offer them that thing that I've become, you know, skilled at, which is kids entertainment, kids comedy. And then, yeah, flew home a couple of days later, told a few friends. They all said, yeah, right. And then 3 months later, we had the money. And then I was like, you said if I got the money and it was real, you'd come. They're like, yeah, but we didn't think you were going to do it. And then we went to Romania, did our first project, and it's never stopped. That was, yeah, that was 12 years ago. And that was just that mission of, I think that everyone, especially when you're little, you need to just feel loved by someone. And that love doesn't have to be parental or whatever. It can be someone just doing their best for you to make you giggle, make you feel valued.
Yeah. So your first group, how many of you were there? How many people did you convince to join you?
There was three of us full time. So my best mate Matt and another of my best friends Naomi, and then I think we had kind of four or five that came and went through that trip. And then, yeah, quite quickly, we kind of gathered a motley crew of misfits and entertainers and funny little people. And yeah.
So when did you start working in refugee camps?
So that was around 5 years ago. You know, we'd worked all over the world. And I guess, you know, one of the slum communities in Ghana, in the center, that there's a lot of people who are living there that were seeking refuge that had come from other countries. But the actual, you know, focused refugee kind of crisis work began 5 years ago in Europe, mainly because we always drove across Europe to get to Romania and back. And you know, we're looking at the paper and there's these horrific and shocking pictures of just thousands and thousands and thousands of people, you know, walking across Europe, sleeping in, you know, the rain. And then when the borders shut, especially the border closed, the Greek border to Macedonia, and the camp there was called Idomeni. There was, you know, at times up to kind of rumored to be 18,000-19,000 people just literally in a field. And amongst them, in spite of what a lot of people who are, you know, have opinions on this might say around 40% were children. And it's normally around that in camps. It's normally around 40%. So yeah, we thought, well, not sure if it's going to be the right thing. Not sure if we're going to be, in the way, really, or in such a serious and such a kind of toxic situation. You're not sure if a clown is the right choice. But actually, 100% it is. Because if the kids are there, they still need cheering up. They still need playtime. You know, they need all those things that kids should have. So yeah, since that was 5 years ago. And since then, that's pretty much taken up all of our focus. We don't do much else now. Sadly, because the situation, rather than kind of going away or getting better, is actually worse probably now than it has been for years.
So you say 40% children. I guess in the news we hear that it's mostly young men, but then we also hear of young children who are lost at sea. So yeah, what is the reality that you see?
Well, it's just not true. Basically, I mean, there is often, you know, depending on where it is. So in Calais, for example, Calais is the border of France, where they get to the English Channel. There are more young men there than elsewhere. But a lot of that is because, you know, the further the road and the more dangerous and treacherous it is, they keep going. You know, it's a very expensive process to walk across the border from Syria to Lebanon and then keep on find what they call informal routes. But if you're that scared, if you're horrifically dangerous, the smugglers are not good people most of the time. It's a criminal activity, you know. So you're forced, it's kind of forced to pay extortionate amounts of money, and then you're often robbed en route anyway. And yeah, it's just a very dangerous journey. So in Greece, I'd say, you know, 40% of the camps are kids. As you get further across Europe, especially now when it's the only route is the informal routes, and yeah, it thins down to men. But again, it's like, I don't know, in Calais, I read something recently because we've had quite a lot of boats coming across into England from Calais, and there's a lot of different opinions on whether or not that's something we should be helping them to come safely, or whether we should be blocking it, or what to do when they arrive, and blah, blah, blah. And it's a lot of people saying, you know, they're all men. But I've worked in Calais, and I'm sorry, but a 17-year-old boy? I would call a 17-year-old a boy. I wouldn't call a 17-year-old a man. I don't have kids myself, but I work with them, and they're babies. You know, a 17-year-old is a baby. And if they've been on their own, which many of them have for years and years and years, you know, they may have fled Syria when they were 12, 13, alone. So by the time they get to Calais and they're 17, you know, they've got such a vulnerable and fragile mental state of essentially a child who's been forced to survive. So to look at, you might see roughed up, toughed up looking young men. But just below that surface are kids who are just terrified. And yeah, you know, and even if you are 18, 20, does that mean that you're less deserving of love? Does that mean just because you're 21 and male, you should be firing a gun at the sky? Like, of course not. We have this phrase I keep hearing recently, which is men of fighting age. You know, why are men of fighting age coming? As I say, like, I've worked a lot. I think, especially in the last year or so, as I've got a bit older, and I'm at father age. I don't have my own kids, but as I've got older and I see those teenagers as kids, actually, they're the ones that stick in my mind the most. So I've been working a lot with what we call unaccompanied minors, so just below 18 years old and on their own. So, you know, I work with those guys, and often 18, 19 and 20-year-olds are there as well. And, you know, they play juggling games and they balance on tight wires, and they're just sweet people who, like anybody else, wouldn't want to pick up a gun and join a fight against what? Russian warplanes and extremist militias. And I wouldn't want to. I'm not a coward, but if I had two small kids and there was a, you know, global superpowers raining bombs above and, you know, religious fanatics coming in from all directions, I'd grab my kids and my wife and we'd leg it fast as we could.
How close do you get to the refugees? Do you like get to know their backstories or like the challenges they've been through to get to where they are?
Do you know what? And if I'm going to be totally honest, we actually try not to, because it's very, very hard when you know that stuff to treat the kids with the right energy. Because and a lot of volunteers do this, not our volunteers, but a lot of people who, you know, their heart has told them just to go and help, and instead of mutual respect and empathy, you can end up having sympathy really easy. And it's a very thin line. Empathy is us on a level. You know, I empathize with what's going on. Sympathy is putting you below me and feeling sorry for you. And I think as much as that is a natural reaction, it's actually not a very it's not a very empowering one when you're working with kids. And also, like, those kids are naughty. Some of these kids, a lot of them, super naughty. And I lay down boundaries. You should, you know, we're strict. You can come and have a great time in our big top. I'll teach you unicycling and all sorts, but we have a, you know, set warning system. It's three strikes and you're out, and you come again the next day. There's a strict no violence rule. You know, there's a mutual respect that I have to kind of enforce. So, and again, I do think I would struggle if I knew the reason why that kid was so naughty is because of, you know, something horrific. Then I may be tempted to allow or to sympathize. I mean, don't get me wrong. I have absolute love and empathy for all of them, and we're not hard. We're just firm on the rules. Because I think it's probably a healthier way to support them.
Yeah.
And, you know, letting them just act out and actually not have any fun. You know, we have so many good kids that end up making such great friends that before structured play would fight with each other all day. And I think, yeah, that's kind of a boundary for me, I think, is so important because it tells that child that you care if they go too far. Do you know what I mean? Like, the reason I'm not allowed out after 10 when I'm 14 is because my parents or whoever's looking after me doesn't want me to be out when it's dangerous. So I kind of feel the same is true in a play environment.
Yeah.
We have boundaries that we all respect. I'm not in charge, but I will enforce boundaries that keep us all, you know, respecting each other and safe from violence.
So, yeah, you've mentioned naughty children. What about, do you ever get any resistance from people, children or just, yeah, people in general who aren't in the mood to be entertained? Do they ever see you turning up and think that you're treating them like a joke or not taking the situation seriously?
I mean, one thing is I'll revoke the word naughty and I'll say children with challenging behavioural habits, because that is the truth. They're not naughty. Just I shouldn't have said that word. I don't like it very much. So I'll take that one back and say children who, you know, blah, blah, blah. Not very often, to be honest. But I think the difference is not the difference, but one of the things we've learned and mastered over the years, you know, before the refugee humanitarian crisis in Europe, we worked in lots of environments where no one invited us to come, where people were up against, you know, extreme challenges and difficulties. So we got quite a lot of experience in reading situations quite quickly and knowing how loud to go, how much to do. And we're professionals. And again, I don't mean any offense to some of the lovely groups I've met, but if you just tie colourful ribbons around your head and jump around saying I'm a clown, yeah, maybe you'll kind of annoy a few people. But, you know, I'm a professional professional kind of circus and comedy performer. So the show is good enough that the parents enjoy it too, I think, is what I'm getting at. So, you know, not only are we respectful of keeping an eye and choosing our location well, like I wouldn't go on a Sunday morning at 9 in the middle of a camp and start playing the trumpet. You know, we do our research. When we get there, we find out where we should work. But then our show's really funny. And I know that may sound arrogant, but it's just, we've done a lot of shows. I've done this for a long time. So yeah, the show is pitched to everybody with a lot of funny stuff for kids, but lots of kind of nice slapstick humor that the adults always enjoy. So yeah, very, very rarely have we had any sort of backlash.
Mm-hmm. So how do the places know that you're coming?
A lot of research. We do a lot of research beforehand on which organisations operate in each camp, if it's a kind of formal camp, which the majority are now. If not, then there's always either grassroots or an NGO, you know, more recognised NGO. There's always somebody working there. So we find out who they are before, we send them emails, we make phone calls. When we get there, we meet them. Before we set foot on site, we always meet whoever's operating and we ask them, you know, strategic questions about how many kids, what's the vibe, things to avoid, blah, blah, blah. But the people in the camps often don't know we're coming. They often have no idea. So we usually start with a parade. I've got a penny farthing bike and a lovely old bass drum. And we literally parade through the camps playing music and calling them to show, which is really, really good fun. That's when you might get a few people like, what? Shut up. But when they realize what's happening, they normally, you know, they chill out a little. And, you know, in Moria camp, which is in Lesvos, it's actually burnt down now a few weeks ago, but it's one of the most horrific places in the world, but in that one there's people living in it's going to sound nice if I say the Olive Grove. It sounds like some kind of new build cul-de-sac in a lovely part of town, but it's just a muddy grove where olive trees grow. And for that one, we just marched up and down these tiny little paths, and the kids would stick their faces out and we'd look at the parents and shake their hands and then say okay, and the kids would follow us off, you know, to a clearing, and then we'd do a show like that. So yeah, it can be mad, can be absolutely wild. You know, you never know exactly how many people are going to come in. You know, you can have 400 or you can have 40, and you've just got to adapt on the spot and quickly.
Yeah. What about, do you struggle with the language barrier?
No, we don't really worry about language. Mm-hmm. If in doubt, I do it in Romanian. No one speaks Romanian, so it's easy. But no, not really. Well, so when we were in Lebanon, it was easier because, you know, everybody spoke Arabic. So we learned the show in Arabic. In Cambodia, I learned it in Khmer. In Romania, I learned it in Romanian. In Africa, we learned it in Twi. So yeah, we always learn the language. But in the camps, it's really different because you've got so many different languages spoken. And if you speak in Arabic, then the Kurds and the Farsi speakers and the, you know, the French speakers are all like, oh, what about us? So we try to kind of avoid it. And so we just have our own semi-made up language. And lots of, like, you can teach people words. If I say, you know, 1, 2, 3, me, 1, 2, 3, after you, 1, 2, 3, okay. That's enough. They'll follow it. And then I've just taught them what my fingers mean. Mm-hmm. One is one and two is two. And okay is always good. Everyone knows okay. So, okay. And then they call it back. And we really focus on call and response. It's all about getting them to participate. So it's kind of from the very beginning of the show, we do a lot of call and response, and we kind of teach them our show vocabulary through some games at the beginning. And then within 10 minutes, they all know what we want them to say, which is remarkable. You have to kind of see it to believe it, how quick these kids are. They're so smart.
Yeah, and it's not too different really from when you interact with like a young child who doesn't know how to speak yet. You just kind of learn through body language and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. And there's so much more to communication than words. You know, like, yeah. I think I put in the book, I've since been told off by a few people that's un-peer-reviewed. It's not peer-reviewed research, that. But in the book I put, which apparently is wrong, but I like it, so I'm going to keep saying it until someone proves me wrong. That 80% of communication is non-verbal. Yeah, okay, maybe it's not that high, but, you know, even just the way you say a word in terms of the facial expression you make can change the meaning of the sentence. So there's so much communication that goes on physically and goes on, you know, in terms of pace or rhythm. You know, you can say something twice in a clown-like playful way and you'll get a laugh. Yeah. And if I do 1, 2, 3, that's the kind of playful vibe. So it's definitely go 1, 2, 3. Mm-hmm. Same words, just so yeah. We kind of just play with tone, and slapstick is essentially better when you don't talk anyway. So lots of that kind of traditional routines, it's when we shut up, it actually works better.
Yeah. Well, I'd believe you with that 80%. I'd probably even say it's higher than that. There's so much that goes into communication.
Mm, good. Let's start spreading the rumor that it's 85.
Yeah. So have you ever been in any sort of dangerous situations or had any risky moments?
Hundreds. We actually have now on the camps, like, okay, in the past we had some pretty edgy moments that were not life-threatening, but they were fairly we worked a lot in Roma communities in Romania, and you just have to approach it in the right way. Again, if you just go in and you haven't got any of the elders of the village, you know, supporting, or you haven't met anyone, and you gather 150 kids without any parents, and you know, and in a school field, so the school teacher's there, but there's one teacher, then that might not work, especially if you don't like having conkers, you know, like horse chestnuts thrown at your head, and then maybe you react and slam your case down and go, that's it, like one of our clowns did. And then it was a bit like, okay, run, you guys run, I'll hold them off and I'll see you later, get in the van and drive away. So we misread, but that was really early on, I have to say. We don't do it as much recently, but yeah, in a mountain community in Albania, we were doing a show. And I teased a guy in the audience, just kind of lightly, like we normally do. And I don't think I should have. He wasn't particularly happy. And yeah, I think there was a few death threats. And it was recommended by our guide that we leave quick because, you know, the police were like 2 hours away. So they said, his words were, you'll be long dead before they get here. Okay, let's go.
So what was this? This was all in the mountain village in Albania?
Yeah, it was just... And I don't know what it was. The guy obviously just woke up on the wrong side of bed, and I made a joke that he didn't find very funny. And it was at his expense, but it was, you know, a playful kind of street performer's gag. But yeah, making him the brunt of it wasn't the right move that day. and I think he was angry before we got there. So I was just the clown on the top of the iceberg or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
And in the camps now, it's like, again, not so much, but, you know, it's a crisis situation. It's not a kid's play space. It's an actual, you're in an emergency. You're in a crisis spot, a conflict zone, you know, if you like. And so we have a safe word. If I say chaplain, or if any of the team say chaplain, it means like walk like Charlie Chaplin as fast as you can. Don't ask me why, like silent, just get out fast, but don't run because you'll panic the kids.
Yeah.
And we haven't had to use that very often. I think once we used it, there was a riot heading towards a huge bunch of police who at the time the police were a bit over aggressive. So lots of tear gas and lots of sticks. When I was in the middle of a magic trick where I eat piles of toilet roll and then I do a magic trick and I pull them out and they're all tied together. So I'd stuffed all these tissues in my mouth. And then it was actually a kid that was going, mister, no good, go, go. I was going, what? And I said, no, wait, kids, wait. Wait, this is the best bit. And they were already half. And then, yeah, to my right was, I don't know, 70, 80 guys with poles. And to my left was 70, 80 police with batons. And
oh, my goodness.
We're in the costume. So, but then a kid just led us. He was just following me. So we grabbed our cases and ran off.
Yeah.
So, but you just always have to be aware. It's not like doing a clown show anymore. We are, you know, we just have to be aware. Riots happen. Police brutality happens. People lose their patience and snap. And yeah, we've got to be aware of all that. Mainly because we don't want to put the kids in a dangerous spot.
Mm. Okay. What about like magic tricks, because there are some cultures where magic is seen as evil or deceitful. Is this something you've ever come across?
Yes, in the rainforest in Ecuador, I had to do the trick and then show them exactly how I did it each time, because a shaman came to town the day before and said, all magic is evil, beware the devil. So yeah, I did the trick and then I go, but it's not magic, because look, and then showed them how to do it. And in Ghana a few times, because there are people in Ghana, for example, who try to say that it's magic in order to extort money from people on the street. And they often use it as a kind of threat. You know, there's this threat of black magic and no one really believes in it properly, but it's kind of scary enough. It's like walking under a ladder is bad luck, but times 50.
Right.
So again, we offered our shows, especially in some of the more religious groups, we'd have to say it's a comedic children's show that uses elements of theatrical illusion. and that seemed to work.
Yeah.
But also we don't do any, you know, we don't do any magic tricks that've got any violence in whatsoever. We don't do any, you know, head spinning or stuff that, A, because I don't want them to copy me, but also for that reason, I don't want to accidentally put any disturbing images in their head. You know, we do silly stuff like we make a cake out of invisible ingredients, there's a flash of fire and a cake is there. Or, you know, I'm locked up in chains and a padlock and I escape within 20 seconds. So it's like really light, a colouring book that's empty and then it's got pictures and then it's got colouring in and disappearing hankies. And it's kind of that sort of stuff, really. So anyone who's offended by that just needs to have a word with themselves.
So you said in the rainforest in Ecuador, what was that? Is that a refugee camp, an orphanage?
No, actually that was before I started the Seagulls. I was kind of, again, travelling and I've joined a kind of conservation project based in a tribe in the Amazon. And my thing was to work with the kids. And then, you know, I ended up, once they found out I was a clown, they were like, you've got to do a show. So I made a few magic tricks. And it was kind of, I guess, an early recce to see what does work and how does it work without language and things. So I don't think I was as consciously researching as that, but yeah, it definitely planted seeds. It was just for fun, really.
So what sort of lives do these children have in the orphanages and the refugee camps? Like, how long are they there?
I mean, it's just so wildly different each place. You know, in Romania, which is where we began, you know, we don't really work in Greece, it's not really, it's just mainly refugee focus. And sometimes we work in some of the Greek schools, kind of trying a bit of integration. And just as really the Greek kids on Lesbos have had a really tough time as well. It's a very tense place. So anyway. So it's really different. Refugee camps are super duper transient. You know, you don't know. Some people have been stuck on Lesbos for years and they're still waiting for an asylum meeting. They haven't even had their first one. You know, you line up and line up and line up. And hopefully if there's not been a riot that day, you might get seen. And they give you your asylum hearing and it's 2 years time. And you just have to wait there for 2 years in a tent, mud. So that can be that. Or we go back the next day and all of a sudden they got no notice at all. And they're like, right, I had one kid. I remember he came and he's like, Bash, every day. He said, Bash, I'm going to Athena. And I go, great. And then the next day he wasn't. I go, I thought you were going to Athena. No, tomorrow. And that went on for 3 months. And then one day he said, I go to Athena. And I didn't really take him very seriously, which is sad because I didn't actually say a proper goodbye because I thought he was just being silly again. Mm. And then that day, him and 20 other families were moved. Boom. They got the notice at 9 o'clock in the morning that they were leaving at 10. So it's just, there's no permanence in those places, and if there is, it's a very brutal, you know, it's not like you settle, it's like you're stuck there. And then orphanages is different in different places. You know, a lot of the orphanages in Romania there's some amazing organizations that work really hard, and the social system in Romania is just so much better than it was, you know, 20-30 years ago. So the kids will stay there till 18 and then you know, have a good start in life, and hopefully they then go on to further support. So yeah, home for life is a something that they definitely, you know, people work for and try for. And then, yeah, it just really, really changes. It's every place is slightly different. You know, Cambodia, in Ghana, some of the kids, it was an orphanage. We were told it was an orphanage. We worked there. The kids slept there. But it turned out they do have parents that are just, you know, an hour or two down the road, but those parents just can't afford to keep them. So the orphanage school them and they live there and eat there and then go home in the holidays. It's almost like a boarding school, yeah, if you like, but without it, good. So this, yeah, peculiar.
Hmm. And so what sort of living conditions do you see?
I mean, again, if we're talking about the last 5 years in the refugee crisis, which is probably the most relevant,
yeah,
it is despicable is the only word. Disgusting, despicable. It's, you know, we were in Samos last year, which is an island in Greece. It's a beautiful island. I don't want to put anyone off going. You should definitely visit Samos, and the Greeks really deserve your money. If you want a holiday, Greece is beautiful. It's open and it's lovely. But yeah, the camp in Samos, there were kids with rat bites, you know, 4-year-old kids getting treated because there's rats that go in their tent at night and bite their face. You know, it's piles of rubbish because the municipalities don't always want to take it, and although there are kind of projects to try and move rubbish, and some places are better than others, but you know, these island hotspots have been, that's what they call the camps, sorry, is hotspots, is so like Samos, Chios and Lesbos. It's like they've been forced to take everyone that arrived and hold them there because of this deal we made with Turkey as the European Union. So it's like they literally have to keep all these people on the islands, and the islands are tiny and they've all got, you know, struggling economies of their own. It's not like Greece is a thriving economy at the moment. And so, you know, the rest of Europe kind of keeps throwing money at big NGOs and at Greece, saying, keep them in Greece. And there comes a point where money doesn't really make much of a difference. You know, the camps are so vast and so under provided for and such poor conditions that you talk about summer tents, you know, summer tents in the winter when it storms. People lose everything and NGOs rush out and give them another crappy summer tent to sleep in for another month until the next time it gets destroyed. And yeah, it's really horrific. Lots of families to one tent. You know, right now the big deal is this Lesbos camp. It burnt down a few weeks ago. They've moved them into a new camp, or they promised it was a temporary measure, but it's been rented for a very long time. And again, like from the sky, when you see a picture, the tents look quite nice. But I've seen these tents before. They're given by UNHCR, the refugee agency, part of the UN. And yeah, they look good, but they're not very strong. And the first wind or the first rain, they don't have, you know, floors that are actually inbuilt. And they don't have, you know, they blow over super easy if the ground is not, you know, solid. And the ground this is on is sand. So again, like you've just got people sleeping directly on the floor on a very thin rubber mat. And if it rains, they wake up like today. They woke up soaked to the bone, everybody. There's no washing machine. There's no hot shower. You just, yeah, it's horrific. And people, not only is their health at risk, but you know, but their mental health and their sense of self is irreparably damaged by this stuff. You know, these kids growing up like this, it's creating such deeply entrenched trauma and such, you know, huge problems within their development that, you know, it'll probably never be healed. Certainly not if they're left there to just rot for another year or two.
So are they relying 100% on the NGOs for their food and shelter?
No, there isn't. There is an obligation. There is some food provided by the Greek state. Very questionable. Like, again, I'm kind of generalizing. Some camps are doing a much, much better job. Some municipalities are doing their absolute best and the food is okay. In the hotspots, it's not that way. So, you know, I think in Moria and Lesbos, before it burnt down, one of the reasons that the tensions got that high was they did an analysis on the NGOs of the nutritional value of the food provided by the municipality. And each person was taking in about 800 calories a day. That's it. And you have to queue up for 3 hours for each one of your meals. If you want breakfast, you start queuing at six. So you think about how many calories you burn, even just standing there in that hot sun.
Yeah.
And then it's, you know, moldy pasta sometimes, or it's just a bun for breakfast. It's just one of those cheap processed croissants, you know, if you're lucky. So, yeah, it's there is food provided and there is provisions. But as I say, that like, the situations that I keep feeling when I talk like this, like I am condemning the camps and I am condemning those island hotspots, but I'm not condemning the islands that are dealing with it, because it's, you know, it's a European wide problem.
Yeah.
And there is space, there is money, there is space, you know, they just need, it needs to be cleared and these families need to be put somewhere safe, because they're kids, you know, they're just people.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because you see such miserable situation. So how do you stay positive and keep your energy up for them?
I mean, to be honest with you, it's the frustration and the kind of rage against the injustice of it that we turn into positive energy. Like, the world is a beautiful and terrible place and people are incredibly loving and horribly selfish, and it's all those paradoxes are just what humans are like. And the only way, when I was really young, you know, like kind of early 20s, the only way I could make peace with that was to do my best to be, you know, to deliver, you know, it's what I do best. If I was a builder and I was a really good builder, I'd probably want to build houses. But I'm really, this is what I do best. And I see the reaction in the kids to it. You know, they really do lift and they feel good and they laugh and play and act like kids. So it's like all of my energy goes to that. And even though I know it's not quite, well, it's not enough. It's not just not quite enough. It's not enough. And it actually is dealing with a symptom. It's not getting to the cause of it. Directly, although hopefully by, you know, encouraging people to view the situation with a slightly more humane approach, then maybe we're having some effect. But yeah, it's that really, you know, and it's got harder and harder. The last couple of years, I think all of my team, you know, we are struggling to stay optimistic. I don't know that I've described myself as an optimist anymore, and I definitely was when we started. You know, I really thought the world could change, and I thought not that we could change it, but we could be part of an energy of, you know, many, many people that leads towards more connection, more unity, and yeah, just being less divisive, and, you know, seeing some of the horrific injustices, and they're not accidental, you know, like they're not landslides, they're not tsunamis and things. They are conscious decisions to enforce policies that actually directly result in people suffering. And I'm not saying, you know, all immigration is fine and anyone who's anti is bad. I don't think that at all. But there is a fair process that is laid out in law. There's an infrastructure that's there. And I might disagree with what they decide in the end. You know, you might apply for asylum and you might be told no. And I might think you should be told yes. But you at least have the right to go through that legal process in an unbiased, fair and justified way, accessing the framework that's been laid out. And that's what's not happening. You know, these camps in Greece, no one's having their meeting. Okay, you get denied asylum and you're sent to somewhere else. Again, I may disagree with that, or you may think that's great. But I think we both agree that that process has to be carried out. And knowing that there's kids and families sitting in the mud, cold and wet, without a hope of even getting a meeting this year, I just, yeah, that doesn't sit well. So, yeah, it is tough, but it turns into energy. And I think someone said to me, oh, what was it? They said, recently I was doing an interview and someone said, you know, you seem to be powered by love. And I was like, no, I'm motivated by love, but I'm powered by anger. I'm so angry that this situation, I'm so angry that these kids could be so devalued. I'm so angry that a certain demographic based on being disabled or being old or being a refugee or being a certain, you know, nationality or race, I'm so angry that that could mean that somehow collectively we agree that your suffering is just part of life. Mm. When we're so well off, you know, you can't have a country like the UK is so divided. You can't have a country with an obesity problem and a child food poverty problem in the same country. That is society not functioning properly.
Yeah.
And I think the same is true, you know, countries all over Europe with huge amounts of empty houses. And okay, maybe they're owned by really wealthy people. Maybe they're not public buildings. I don't particularly care. But I know that there's enough houses in London to house every single person in Moria in their own house. There's like 125,000 empty properties and there's only 8,000-9,000 people there. They could each have their own house and we wouldn't even notice.
Yeah.
But we don't. It just seems a bit brutal to me.
Mm. So when you leave these places, do you leave feeling uplifted or do you feel emotionally shattered?
Emotionally shattered, 100%. You're shattered. Yeah, you can't leave it. We leave proud. I'm not going to hide from that. You know, I'm really proud of my team. All of my team are brilliant. They work. You know, most of them are volunteers. I've got a core crew. Izzy, Becky and Bendik, and then some other kind of repeat customers, my apprenticeship team. And these guys will, you know, they absolutely blood, sweat and tears would give and do give their last drops of energy. So I'm proud of them. And I'm, you know, we just keep going. We're a fairly relentless team. You know, we'll do 7-8 shows a day, even though the average person would consider 3 a bit over the top. But you do leave, as I said earlier, like you kind of leave with the knowledge that, although, you know, those kids have got positive memories from it and they've got something joyful to think back on. And in years to come, you know, even since, we've had kids that have contacted us who are no longer in that situation saying that, you know, that one of their father contacted me and said that, you know, through everything that we remember, we all smile and feel happy because you guys were there. And like stuff like that, you go, cool. And it's not a big deal that we're doing. We're just, you know, performing real, real funny stuff in a big energized way. So yeah. That keeps us going. But yeah. You do feel heartbroken when you leave. And actually the toughest thing is when you get home, to be honest, because you find it really hard to kind of relax into the easy comfort of life, popping down to the cinema with your mate or, you know, meeting your friends and going to the pub and spending 25 quid on a load of pints and some, you know, peanuts and a burger. And it's not that you shouldn't enjoy it. It's just how easy it is for us to have such ready comfort and how insanely difficult is for them even just to get a croissant for breakfast.
I have a hot shower.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I have a hot shower every day. I go for a run most days and I shower afterwards. These guys would be lucky if they have a hot shower a fortnight because they'll have their allotted time, if there even is one. And when they do shower, it's probably standing on a muddy pallet in an NGO shower unit. So, yeah, it's tough. It's tough, but it just motivates you to come, you know, and that's it. You just grit your teeth and go, right, let's convince some more people. And now we've got 4 or 5 teams operating, you know, basically full time. So the message is spreading and the motivation is building rather than diminishing.
So, yeah, tell me about your teams. Who are your volunteers? What sort of experience do they have?
It's a real mishmash. So of my core, I've got like a core team who kind of now run it with me, which is a girl called Izzy, we call her Wolfie, Becky is BB, and then Bendik is Benno. And they're just very different. So Wolfie studied international community theatre or something like that, and then moved into it that way. I think Becky is an actress, but also been very involved in kind of girl guides and youth movements in that way. And then Benno is a Norwegian clown who trained at Le Coq in France. So kind of everyone brings a slightly different back experience. But the thing that kind of is same throughout them is there's this bombasticity to them. You know, like they just say yes, they jump in before they even know what in is. And they do it with huge smile on their face. And, you know, they'll go into some very dangerous environments and very, you know, dark places and roar with the energy of 10 lions, a song that gets the kids, you know, sing along with them. And so that's, they're a very kind of admirable and incorrigible bunch of funny old misfits. And then, And then we have, you know, circus performers and street performers. And, you know, last tour we had a guy, Chris Panic. He's like a legend of the circus world in the UK, like family circus. He's 73. He came to join us, was all of our father or grandfather and my, one of my best mates now. And, you know, that's just a real cross section, but with the shared intention of just bringing energy in. And, you know, we're not particularly good at circus skills. My magic is okay, but we're really good at making a simple magic trick take 20 minutes and fill the energy, you know, fill the space with energies. You know, you'll watch, I could do a show for an hour and at the end, you wouldn't be able to say exactly what happened or even if anything happened, but it was fun.
Yeah. So how many volunteers do you have altogether? Well, I guess, does it change a lot? Do you constantly have people coming and going?
Yeah, it changes a lot. We've got four core team and we've got four team leaders and nine core team. And they're kind of the runners of things. So the core team just did a year-long apprenticeship into the Seagull Project to become kind of core members. Mm-hmm. And then we probably have had, like last year, we probably had 120, 150, a couple of hundred over the year. Wow. Obviously, at the moment, it's less. Mm-hmm. But we do a bit, you know, we raise our funds at festivals as well. So we do, you know, Glastonbury Festival, book us, and we'll take 10 to 15 people each weekend to help us perform and raise money at festivals. So it is fairly nonstop and continuous groups of people.
That's what I wanted to ask was about your funding. So you said you do Glastonbury, where else does it come from?
It's a mixed bag, really. So festival-wise, we do in England, we do 21 festivals now in 14 weeks, which is ridiculous. It's 3 days each one, 9-hour shows a day, with a day before to set up and a day after to pack down, and then one day to rest and one day to clean and wash everything ready to start again. So we do that back-to-back for 14 weeks in the summer. And that's in England. We've got 8 in Norway, and we're just launching in the Netherlands at the moment, so we'll have another few there, no doubt. So that's kind of quite good. And that's good because it's not only do we obviously get paid by the festival to put on, you know, the kid shows and things, but also so it's the most amazing way to not just tell people what it is we do, but, you know, their kids come and enjoy it. And then I say, this is what we do. And the same energy that got your kids all, you know, happy and silly, we just don't think that should be limited to people at festivals who are lucky enough to live here or afford the ticket. So if you've got a few quid, please, you know, go and buy a T-shirt or pop it in the pot. And so from that, we pick up lots of really lovely, generous people who, you know, either they buy a load of stuff there, we've got little kind of silly bits of merchandise, or they just start giving us money, you know, each month a fiver or a tenner. So, you know, we've got quite a lot of people who do that now. Mm-hmm. And then some, you know, there's some great organizations, some grants, some private donors, some, you know, not many. We don't take government money, not that we've been offered, but... I kind of think, you know, there's stuff that should be going towards that. You know, as much as I know what we do is essential, it's not the same as healthcare, housing or food. So lots of people give us a little bit of money. And then we've got these amazing team of kind of the Seagull kids, you know, junior Seagull squad. And there's like, you know, two or three kids across, probably more now, kind of five or six across the UK, who just keep raising money for us. You know, one little girl, Matilda, I don't know how old she is now. I'm going to get this wrong and she'll hear it and kick my butt because she listens to everything we do. I think she's 12, 13. I'm sorry, Tilly, if that's not true. But Matilda's probably been raised in excess of £5,000 for us since she was 7.
Wow.
You know, just keep... She sells her toys. She went in the street and busked every Saturday with her trumpet for 6 months one summer. And, you know, she's so driven and so motivated that... She'll probably be my boss in no time. As soon as she's old enough, we'll hire her and sack me, and she can run it. So we make money that way, and then we're just very frugal on the road. You know, we've got a skeleton team in the UK. We have got someone who helps us to kind of fundraise. Who works for us, Tanya. She's great. And then I just do a lot of talking. I talk to anyone that will listen, and often that means you can pick up. Support from people that are unlikely. You know, once I was chatting to someone at a festival, they turned out to be extremely influential people behind a very major trust led by a supermarket. So we suddenly got enough money to hire a fundraiser for 2 years out of the blue.
Yes.
Their kid liked our show. We became friends. They're super lovely people and they had the means to help us. So that kind of helps. I have no shame and no fear. So I will basically talk the hind leg off a donkey, is what we say in England. And as you can tell, the fact that each answer is about 2 hours long so far.
No, I really, really like this. Yeah, so having heard about everything that goes on in like the orphanages and the refugee camps, how do you then view Western kids back home who are in a state of always wanting more and never being satisfied with all they have?
I mean, kids is kids. You know, we can't blame kids for anything. I don't kind of try to characterize. I think all behavior exhibited by children anywhere is a result of their environment and a result of the influences or the, you know, or the energies that they're surrounded by. And we are relentless in the kind of, let's say, in brackets, Western world, or let's say that they're kind of capitalist West. It's relentless advertising. It's relentless comparison based on what you have and what you don't have. And, you know, it's no wonder that kids have got this kind of ever increasing hunger, as you know, not all kids, but some, that ever increasing hunger for stuff, because we're meant to. That's what advertising is aiming to achieve. You know, there's never enough. And I think it's a real shame. I think it's something that we have to be very careful of. I think, you know, hugely toxic, because the result of thinking you haven't got enough, unfortunately, is thinking that you're not enough. You know, you grow up thinking, I remember in school, it was much less then, but it was still present, not having the right trainers or not having the right jacket or not having the right football shirt. You know, we didn't have much money and I really wanted an English football shirt. Not that I loved football, but every other kid had one and I was embarrassed. You know, so like the pressures even then, and that was before social media, before all this digital revolution. I can't imagine how it makes a kid feel now when their world is framed and objectified in endless amounts of photographs and self-promotion like you know, social media encourages. So yeah, I think it's a shame because it's just stuff, isn't it? It's just layers on top of who you are, not what you are. And I think we're not kind of not teaching our kids, or at least we're not holding companies that teach them the wrong thing to account fully enough. You know, they shouldn't be. Facebook should be more responsible. The capitalist world who markets to children should zip it and get out of the way when they're playing. It's enough. They're kids. They are enough. Everybody's enough. And yet we're teaching them they're not. I think it's a tricky and unhappy place that we're creating. And we need to be a bit more cautious about it.
I like how your book validates the right of a child to play, you know, how essential it is to physical, emotional and cognitive development. So what's your take-home message that you would like the listeners to take away on the real play revolution?
I mean, that book I made a speech a bit like what I just did then. I got on my soapbox at a festival and I ranted about computer games or something. I think I challenged the CEO of Minecraft to a battle and the kids thought that was hilarious. But and then someone came up and said, would you write this book? And it took a lot of thought. And actually, it was because of their guidance. They said it has to be 50% activities. You can't just rant for the whole time or no one will want to read it. And luckily they did. And I did. So. And the more I thought about it, you know, at one point I actually had a like minor meltdown and I went into like a huge fury. And my girlfriend was like, what's wrong with you? I was like, I'm writing all this stuff, but it doesn't really matter what game you play. As long as you're present, you've just got to be present. What am I even writing? And I got in a kind of semi-rage. So I thought, I'm over-intellectualizing something so simple, which is, you know, all a kid wants is you in your to be fully present and to play. And that's it. Doesn't matter what you play, doesn't matter if you've got a thing. They just want you to be with them and to engage in that lovely, light, non-competitive energy of play. Mm. Whether they're 2 years old or whether they're 10. You know, maybe when they're 10, they might want you to play football or they might want you to play, I don't know, racing game on the computer. But really what they actually want, and it's so easy because you just got to offer you and all of you. And that's the best play resource you could ever offer a kid, but it comes with caveats. You know, you can't offer you whilst also texting someone at work. If you're going to play, you put your telephone down, make it sacred, make it special. Because I think I put it in the book it's a quote. I don't know who said it. Maybe I made it up. I hope I did. It's really good, but maybe someone else did. And it was something like, play is the indigenous language of the child. Like, play is how they express and how they interact and how they are them. You know, it's how they communicate. And if you think back to when you were a kid, your best mate, you'd arrive at their house, you already knew the 10 best games you're going to play. Hey, do you want to go upstairs? And we could do, and you know, you never just, I don't know about you, I never made a Lego model like it showed on the box. You know, you make it maybe once, then you break it down and build something else and something else and something else. And
yeah,
I think my message is that you're enough and they're enough. And it doesn't matter what you've got, whatever you've got with the right energy is going to be great to play with.
We've been using some of the card games you gave as an example in your book, like the Hide the Shoe game. And our oldest is only, we really like that one. Yeah, our oldest is only 4, so he tries to join in, but sometimes my husband and I play them when it's just the two of us because we find them so entertaining. What tips do you have for engaging children in a way that's entertaining for the adults too?
I mean, I think it's just being authentic. I mean, a lot of adults, and I think, of course, you know, when they're little, there is a bit of goo goo gaga, but I think being yourself, being honest, like funny is funny. Okay, different comedy for adults. Don't swear, don't make, you know, innuendo, stuff like that. But like the shows we do, adults, like at festivals, adults laugh just as much as the kids. You just got to really be yourself and then it's fun. And you genuinely will have a good time with your kids and you'll genuinely enjoy the game. I think when we feel like we have to put on a kind of different face when we're with them, and as I say, like that comes with the acceptance that, of course, there is a different version of you than the one down the pub who makes your mates laugh. But the more authentic you can be, the more fun you'll have and the better you'll interact with each other. And even saying things like, yeah, this game's a bit boring. Can we play something else? I say that with my nephew all the time. You know, my niece and nephews, and I've got 2 nephews and 3 nieces. And, you know, anytime there's a play date, sometimes I'll just go, oh, it's boring. I'm bored. I don't want to play this anymore. And that's okay to say, rather than playing it but only half-heartedly and thinking, when can I get out of it?
Mm-hmm.
So, did I answer your question? What was your question?
Yes. Do you think you can give us some examples of games that listeners could do with the children in their own community?
I mean, I love Wonky Wardrobe Challenge, and there's, you know, this is a good one because it also means you have to get a little bit less precious about your clothes. But what you do, this is really for a family at home. In the wider community, it might be a bit strange, but in the family home, you basically go into your wardrobe and you get out, this is the adults, and you get out piles of clothes, 3 or 4 pairs of trousers each in 2 piles, if you're lucky to have it, like stack it up. And then you make teams, you know, try and split them off, you know, split yourselves up fairly evenly, adults and kids mixed in. And then you've got 1 minute to put on as many items of clothing as you possibly can as a team. And the winning team is the ones that are wearing the most clothes. So you might end up with 8 jumpers on and 5 pairs of trousers. And yeah, I love that game. I think it's silliest nonsense. And it looks really funny because you end up wearing, you know, you mix it all in. You might end up in your mum's dress or, you know, it just doesn't matter. So that's my favourites for home. I think that's fun. And
fun.
Then the wider community, like, I don't know, there used to be this kids' TV show in England called Dick and Dom in the Bungalow. And I loved them. They're bonkers. And they used to do a thing called Fogey Bogey. So fogey is like a word we use for, like, not a very polite word, but in the old days we used to call elderly people old fogies. And then obviously bogey is what we use to describe the snot from your nose. And in this TV show, they used to send these really funny old people. Like, you could nominate your granny or your granddad, and they go into like museums and they have to shout bogey louder than the other one. And it's just like so ridiculous that you've got these old folk who were meant to be, you know, by cliche and by societal plan, quite straight laced, and they're in the middle of, you know, the National Gallery going bogey. So I think in the book, make a loud noise now. So you make a comedic contract, because otherwise grown ups cop out of stuff. So you literally make a comedic contract. As in, I think you'll probably see me in the book where you agree to a set of rules, right? Me and my daughter, or you and your son, you're going to go into town, and it's a game called Make a Loud Noise Here. So you both agree we're going to play, Make a Loud Noise Now. So that means we've got 3 credits each. And whenever I say now, you have to make a seriously loud noise. And it's really embarrassing. But it's kind of like, again, like, don't do it next to someone who's sleeping. Don't do it in a mean way, and that could be in your contract, like not to be done in a mean way.
Mm-hmm.
But interacting with society in a silly way again starts to break down that preposition that we have to be presented as perfect all the time, or you always have to be cool, or as I say, if you've got the right trainers, this just make a loud noise on a tube train. Brilliant. It'll make everyone else giggle, especially when they look over and they see that it's, you know, a parent and their kid laughing their socks having made a silly noise. It will cheer everybody up. And just that kind of the barriers between us in public spaces becomes slightly less and slightly more playful.
Yeah, it's like a diminishing of the ego as well.
Mm. Oh, yeah, it's no space. What is ego anyway? Ego is actually, ironically, the opposite of what it's meant to be. It's actually you saying, I'm a bit embarrassed rather than I think I'm amazing. You know, we all know as you get older, the more egotistical, the more fragile they are underneath.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just do away with it. Just be yourself. Be yourself at all time. It's always enough. And someone will think you're annoying, but someone else will think you're amazing. So nothing to lose.
Can you tell us about the Hide the Shoe game?
Yeah. So this is, I have to give the credit. This is to my friend Melody. She taught me this game. So you can play it anywhere, but in the car is good. And so whoever's turn it is will say, I've hidden the shoe. And in their head, they've hidden the shoe somewhere in the past, present, future, in film, in the real world, in their imagination, in a concept, in between. Like one of my friends has hid it in between the letter I and the letter N in the word in. And they hid it in between the two letters. And you get there and you have to ask questions like, I think it's got to be yes, no answers, isn't it? So you say, is it fictional? No. And you have to track down this shoe. One of ours was, it was in the bass drum of Iron Maiden's 1988 tour. You know, so another, I think my niece once hid it in Granny's washing machine. And you basically say, in your head, hide the shoes somewhere. And then everyone has to take it in turns to ask you yes, no questions and find the shoe. And if they do, it's their turn.
Yeah.
But you can be as imaginative as you like. It was on the head of the Statue of Liberty once. The Queen was wearing it once.
So much fun.
Yeah, there's no end. Yeah, I love it.
So now how have you guys been affected by COVID?
Well, it's pretty much a game changer, isn't it, for live performances. I mean, you know, our entire focus for years has been gathering people together who don't like to stand too close. And now we have to separate people out who like to come together. So it's a really, you know, it's a fairly big, decent thorn in our side. And also massively around the camps, because there isn't enough healthcare and they're, you know, they're living in an environment that is super unhealthy and runs their immune systems down anyway. Mm. So it hasn't felt like the right or responsible thing to do yet. And we haven't figured out a safe way to operate within the camps since the COVID outbreak, or we haven't been allowed in. So, to begin with, I kind of refused to accept it, and I made hours and hours and hours of online play footage called Sunshine TV, which is, you can find it on YouTube. It's very funny, some of it. Some of it is obviously a man living in a warehouse not accepting lockdown. So, some of it is definitely like filmed at 1 a.m. where I actually am feeling like I don't know what time it is anymore. I don't know how many days I've been here. And then it's just time to adjust. You know, we did the right thing. We kept quiet. We didn't, you know, stir everybody up. But then we go, okay, well, this is going to go on. In England, it's still going on to this day. We're looking at actually, you know, restrictions are coming back in rather than going out now. Hmm. In Greece, it's incredibly strict around refugee camps, less so in the rest of the country. But, you know, it's a good excuse to clamp down even further on the demographic living there. So we just had to get imaginative. So in the UK now, we've actually launched Flying Seagulls into the UK a lot more. We've done a few things over the years, but we thought, you know, whilst we're all sitting here, we might as well be active. So we have two teams out across England, and they are going into schools, community centres, spaces where kids have been cut off, you know, really seriously cut off. Like if you're in respite care or if you're in the young carers, you know, living in a tough spot where you don't have two parents and one of them's got an underlying health issue, you can't go out at all. So we've been doing that stuff. In Norway, we had a bus that's also a stage, and that toured continuously through lockdown because they were allowed, and they parked up outside of kids' homes. The stage opened, and with amplification, they would do shows for kids in their windows. obviously, permission of the orphanage. It wasn't just like the child catcher from Chitty Bang Bang. It was proper. Mm. And we are now, I'm in current process of creating the Flying Showmobile, which is a Luton-style van, in a van with a kind of bit over the cab. And this side is being cut out and turned into a stage so that we can literally climb from the front to the back, lower the stage, do a show, raise the stage, climb back and drive out without actually putting foot in the camp. Which means, I think, that we can say we are entirely COVID secure because the kids cannot get within 2 meters of us. So if it works, you know, we're trialing it this year in the asylum centers in Netherlands and Greece. If it works and we can get, you know, good testimonials and feedback from them, I'm really hoping that means early next year we can, you know, we can seek permission from the Greek government to operate in the camps again.
Yeah.
So yeah, it has been that really. We've had to really stop and just get imaginative and think, how can we play? We are used to getting people in a circle, but you can't because people muddle up. So today I've spent the day designing an 8 meter play mat where we've got dots 1.5 meters apart all the way around the outside and then ever diminishing sized circles 1.5 meters away from each other so that we can literally have a socially distanced play mat. And we say, right, kids, everyone stand on a red spot. And by doing so, they're then not in contact with each other or us. So we're kind of trying to adapt, trying to use our imaginations. And yeah, we've had to go online. I hate going online. I can't stand performing. You know, I did a clown school a few weeks ago and I just felt like a Wally. I thought, is this even working? I can't even see you all. I don't even know if you're smiling. I can't meet my audience. And so we've had to do that. And we get there, it's getting there. And in a way, actually, it's taking on that challenge of, with a world so digital and screen obsessed, can we infiltrate that with some genuine energy? And I think we kind of can. It's just we're fast tracked to have to do it a lot more than we wanted.
Yeah.
Yes. And no festivals. First time in 10 years, we haven't spent the summer racing from one showground to another. So
peculiar. Yeah, because you were saying you were doing it for like 14 weeks at a time. But so that didn't happen this summer.
No, not a single one. Not a single one, which, you know, is worrying, really, because we don't meet half the people that might support us. And I mean, to be honest with you, I think people have got a lot going on now anyway, in terms of, you know, businesses struggling and stuff. So
yeah.
We're not going to ask for too much cash from people anyway. But yeah, it was a very strange summer. I'd had my first summer holiday in 12 years. It was great.
Wow. Because, yeah, I'm imagining your life, well, like prior to COVID, almost like that of a musician, constantly traveling from one country to another, putting on a show every, what, second night. But is that what it was really like?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, not kind of country to country, not so much. But you know, we were always on the road. Like in your introduction, you said I kind of live on the road and in a less glamorous way than maybe Def Leppard or Iron Maiden might have. It's like, you know, we go from one crisis spot to another. We spent the last 6 months mainly in Samos, which is this island, as I say, with a big camp on it on the Aegean coast. We built a big top. So that was our Cirque de Samos project. So we built a big top directly over the road on some rented land across the road from the camp. And we ran for 3 months continuously. And then we were in the middle of our spring one when lockdown happened. And so, yeah, we just go from one place to another. We have to tour. We had to tour Norway with a show that we were putting on. You know, wonderful opportunity to raise some funds and things. So we'd go from Norway. We'd do 2 weeks touring, get back to Lesbos or Samos, and then go to the mainland, work in the squats in Athens and, you know, and I say squats, it's not like kind of rock and roll squats. Again, it's families living in derelict buildings. So yeah, always on the go, non-stop. Yeah.
Did you guys, I'm assuming this is like all of you, you and your team and the volunteers, did you get much time to recharge, like some downtime?
I mean this summer, yeah.
But prior to being stuck?
No, not really. I mean, I say you kind of, it's difficult to take that moment. We are trying more as an organization, like, you know, to recognize in each other, like, you know, mate, you need to have a few weeks to yourself. But it's very hard to switch off because you come back with the full knowledge, as I said before, like they're still there and that situation hasn't stopped. So yeah. you can't really indulge too far into relaxing because your head is always, or your heart, I should say, your heart stays in the camps and your head is thinking about when can you get back there. So. Yeah, most of us have become, you know, relatively unattached to being in our home countries, if you like, in brackets. So we're mostly all focused on where the next project is going to be.
Yeah. So now how can the listeners help you? Is a monthly donation the best way, or are there other like non-monetary ways they can help?
Yeah, I mean, obviously donations are always, you know, gratefully received, and we only survive, as I said earlier, we haven't got major grants. We don't do that sort of, we haven't got the time to apply for them. And individual people giving us money, fantastic. I think a really important one would be to remain active and present in, like, caring and finding that something unfair or difficult to deal with is only the first step. Like, keeping the pressure on, you know, looking at what's happening, staying engaged, not being passive. But, you know, like in Australia, for example, there was, you know, a friend of mine, I did an interview with an Australian TV channel a while ago, and they said the same. I was like, well, you've got a migration policy that makes people suffer. So, you know, maybe you could put pressure on. And in New Zealand, I'm sure there are places that really could do with people's love becoming more than just a passive observation on Facebook. There's always something you can do. There's putting yourself on the line is actually far more effective sometimes than a nominal sponsorship. You know, tenner a month is great, amazing to us. We're tiny, but someone like Oxfam, you know, they're doing huge jobs, and that money does go somewhere. But if you went down and physically supported a homeless shelter over Christmas, for example, then, you know, you're kind of putting your money where your mouth is. Ideally, do both. Give a tenner a month and go do something. But then you can also get into a microcosmic level. I know this is getting a bit preachy, so I'll step back from that a little. But someone on your road, someone who's in your street, has got something that you could help them with. You know, there's something there, I don't know, they can't fix their guttering and you're really good at fixing guttering. Or they need to go to the shop and they haven't got their license because they've got, I don't know, some reason why they can't drive. Like, someone on your street needs your help. And you probably need someone on your street's support in some way. So actively go seek them out. And if you just do that once a month, find someone on your street to help. And what a lovely world we'll have. Imagine if everybody does it. If all 7 billion people on the planet, we all go, right, for an hour a month, I'm going to find someone near me who needs a hand with something. It'd be wonderful. And then, you know, the friends we'd make and the connections we'd make. And that's really all we're doing with the Seagulls. I just want people to feel good. And I want the joy of friendship and the obvious benefit of us being kind to each other to be a kind of more prominent force in society. And it's easy because most of us feel it. Most people feel the desire to be kind of kind, look out for each other. It's nice when you help someone out. Actually, you know, we all know giving gifts is much nicer feeling than getting them. Don't be wrong, I'm a good present, but that feeling you get when you give someone something they want, oh, it feels super, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's like you're bringing back a sense of community almost.
Yeah, and then finally, if you're parents, just, you know, give your kids a time of day, not just in passing, like find, and I know it's so easy for me to sit here and say it, and it was like, mate, I've got two jobs, my wife works 7 days a week, we're struggling. But if you can find even half an hour a week and call it like playtime, sacred playtime, you lock it in and you put your phones to one side and it is, you know, there is nothing that can come between it, then you also honour your kid and, you know, you honour their childhood with recognition. And I think that will help them as they grow up to do the same as what we just said. What all that is honouring someone's needs, isn't it? And if we teach our kids that by doing that with them and by showing them that feeling good and feeling loved is kind of one of the world's riches, and it's the cheapest one because it's just energy, then hopefully that will, you know, sneak into their later life as well.
Mm. Well, I will put links in the show notes to the Flying Seagull Project website and your book, The Real Play Revolution. Is there anywhere else you recommend sending people who would like to learn more or to get in touch with you?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's loads of stuff on YouTube in terms of, you know, as in if you want to know more about what we've done or have a look at kind of some of the places we've been or some of the messages we've tried to share, that's cool. Read the book, that's good. There's a fairly boring bit in the middle, but I didn't edit it, so that's not my fault. I do apologize. At the very least, it's a good door stopper if you can't stand the inside, so that's good. That's good. Facebook, just get involved, have a look, say hello. Mm-hmm. And also, if you like something, you know, if you'd like a game or something, just send us a message and tell us. I think that's kind of what I'm trying to do that more recently. I realize that I watch someone's video or I, you know, listen to someone's podcast, if you like, and I think, whoa, cool. And I forget to message them. I think, why not just send a message saying, loved your podcast?
Yeah.
But it's nice to hear. There's this guy, Nick Hart. he's got such a good voice. He's this kind of English folk singer that we just discovered, me and my girlfriend. And I just can't stop listening to his songs. And I found out that he's a friend of a friend on Facebook. So I dropped him a message. Wow. Just said that. I said, yeah, me and my girlfriend listened to your album, 8 English Folk Songs. Loads. It's brilliant, man. Thanks very much. Great voice. Cheers for sharing. Look forward to the next one. And I don't think I've ever done that before. But I thought, isn't it nice just to kind of reach out and compliment someone? So, yeah, if you like us.
It brightens their day. Yeah.
Yeah, really does. I mean, we got lovely messages from people like, you know, saw your show at Wilderness Festival, thought you were great. And it's so motivating and so encouraging, especially almost more so from a stranger. So, yeah, if you like any of it, send me a message and say, go on, that's all right.
Ish, this has been such an insightful interview. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and share your knowledge with us.
Oh, pleasure. And thanks so much for asking. I hope I didn't kind of rabble on too long.
Oh, you rabbled on perfectly.
Yes. And yeah, appreciate it. Look forward to checking out some others on your list.
So, yeah, my final question for you to end on is, if the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be?
I was thinking about this all week after you didn't doubt me that might be a question, because this is improvised. And I've been trying to come up with whatever. So I had a couple, and I thought one's a bit preachy. So I thought I'd just keep it really simple, which is what my godfather used to say, which is, it's nice to be important, but it's more important to be nice.
Oh, that's a good one.
That'll do. It's a little bit cheesy, but I kind of, yeah, I like that. The other thing he used to say is, which I really like, but this isn't the only, if it was one sentence, I wouldn't say this, but in general, for conflict resolution, he said, least said, soonest mended. And I've started using that. When I feel like wanting to go in on it, I just think, just say little and it will fix itself much quicker. Least said, soonest mended.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.